Hi, everyone. Hey, we're back together for another campfire conversation, garden gathering conversation, since we're putting this on both the Secret Garden and Base Camp. And I'm excited about this one tonight because I know well the man that we're going to be talking with, and that's Matt Tailford. We've known each other over the years, actually. I'm not sure how many years, but quite a few anyway.
Yeah.
And we've had some great conversations. I love what Matt is doing. In fact, if we all were literally standing around a campfire or somewhere in a garden circled up and talking, I think we'd say what Matt is doing has been one of our secret dreams, is to somehow be involved in the movie-making industry. And of course, that's from our experience of sitting in a movie and being touched by it. But most of us had never been behind the scenes of what that's like. So, Matt, thank you for joining us on this, and we're just excited to hear about your life.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, you're welcome. You know what we'd love to do? And yes, I would love at some point during our conversation maybe for you to kind of let us know, what's it like to be on the inside, or maybe the word is on the backside of movie making. But what I'd love to do, what we would be most interested in, is really hearing your life, your journey, because above all things, you know, the people in Base Camp and in Secret Garden are just fascinated with a person's life more than anything else. So, you know, let's go back and let's just trace desire, the assault against those desires, God's development work in your life and deepening, and his moments of letting you fulfill those things. Let's kind of trace that through, because I know I'd be fascinated by that, and am with what you've told me already. So
yeah.
go back to wherever you want to go and start telling us about where an idea of being involved in, let's say, storytelling first came up.
Storytelling specifically, I don't know. I can trace back to maybe when I was 7 or 8, 9 years old, when I wanted to be an actor. I'd run around the house singing "You Ain't Nothing But a Hound Dog" to the Elvis albums in the house, and of course entertain the family.
Uh-huh.
But that quickly got shot down. I think it was short lived.
How did that get shot down? How did that kind of assault, that diminishment, come at you?
Well, you know, I don't remember exactly all the specifics. You know, I mean, originally it was my sister Tam, and God love her. She's we get along famously today, but she's so practical. When, you know, she casually said, she was probably in high school at the time, actors, she'll never be an actor. That's like a one in a million job.
Oh.
I think that was like, okay, I guess maybe that's out.
Is this an older sister?
Yeah, well, she's 11 years older than me. So,
okay. So those have even more weight to them when an older sibling, kind of more experienced in life, kind of puts something like that on you.
Yeah, for sure. And then my childhood was between my relationship with my father and the emotional abuse there, and the not physical abuse on the part of my father, but physical abuse sexually as a little boy. I think that had an effect on me as well. And that kind of put me, and how that affected me directly, I can point to in school. Education just wasn't that important to me. So in the 70s, when I was in elementary school, there was little known about how kids learn and process information. And I think they took away gym, they took away art class, they took those things away because you had to earn those things. It was reading, writing, and arithmetic. And, of course, the gym was what I needed. The art room was what I needed to express myself. And by the time I got out of high school, it was, you know, the last thing I wanted to do was anything to do with school. So I joined the Marine Corps right out of high school.
Now, okay, so why did you join the Marine Corps?
I wanted to know if I had what it took to be a man.
Hmm.
And I didn't know at that point in my life. I'd experienced a lot of things, but I didn't know if I could take a punch and give one, you know. My idea of what being a man was Rambo and Top Gun. And I, in my eyes, I fell way short of those.
My assumption is in your mind, any sort of artistic, you know, development expression had no place in that, or at least no reinforcing place in that idea of being a man or masculinity.
No, not at all. Quite the opposite, you know. I didn't dare try theater in high school. I think there was a few times where I wanted to, but there just wasn't. I played hockey, and I was playing hockey out of obligation, I think. My family was big into hockey in the community, and that's just what we did. So hockey players aren't, you know, you can't be an artist and an athlete. It just doesn't work.
Not allowed, anyway. So just real briefly, what was your experience like in the Marine Corps?
Boot camp was amazing. I think it was the first time in my life where I was functioning all cylinders. I won't say how many, but they were, I don't know, I felt I was proud of myself. I was proud of what we did. You know, I felt like I had a purpose. And I felt like I was giving back. I was somehow doing my part and being part of something bigger than myself in being a Marine. And that was great. And then I got to the fleet, and this was a really interesting time in the Marine Corps because it was before Desert Storm. There was not much going on, and there was even talk of disbanding the Corps at one point. They were giving early outs, and there was a lot of drugs, a lot of sex, a lot of things that being from a more conservative family, more protected. I had my exposures to some bad things, but it opened my eyes to the world for sure. And I didn't have the tools I needed in my toolbox to really know how to deal with some of the things that were thrown my way, or some of, you know, the repercussions of some of the choices I made as a Marine and as a young man, for sure.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so keep us going down the road on your journey. So you leave the Marine Corps. Now, what's maybe the next significant event that would be good for us to hear?
Well, I got out of the Marine Corps, and I got away from the drugs, the booze, and the craziness. And throughout this whole journey, though, you know, I mean, I really felt that I was a Christian. I mean, I prayed conversationally to God all the time. And so I got out of the Marine Corps, and I knew that I was just, I needed to get into a better situation. Going home wasn't what I needed to do. So I ended up going to Cedarville College, which is down in Ohio. It's a Christian college, a very conservative school. And I thought, you know, if I surrender myself with Christians, then, you know, that's definitely the way to go. Then I'll be out of trouble, and there won't be any, you know, there won't be negative influences. This, of course, is not the case. But nonetheless, I ended up in school, and I worked full-time, went to school part-time in Cedarville, met some great Christian professors down there. Ended up transferring to Hope College, and when I transferred to Hope College during my freshman year, it was the first time I didn't have to go to school and work. I took student loans out, was eligible for some financial aid, and I always wanted to be in a play. So I thought, heck, you know, why not? So I tried out and got into a play, and it changed my life. It changed the way that I viewed education. It changed the way that I viewed the world. I think I read my first book when I was 25.
Whoa, really?
Cover to cover, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I just had no desire to... Well, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, keep going. You had no desire.
No one had ever showed me what good could come from reading books, and how it could broaden my view of life and the world and of people and of myself, and just it's all a very new experience for me. So when I read, I read things almost as if they're a play, kind of playing out before me, and it's like writing a script. It's kind of like sculpting with words. It's just different. Learning's different. Reading's different. Everything changed when I was 25.
So here you are, a young boy. You have this dream, this desire, this idea of being an actor. It gets slammed pretty quickly, and then everything else around you kind of reinforces the idea that you'll never be that. Let's get serious. So that desire goes underground for a long time, it sounds like.
Yeah.
You go to Hope College, you see an opportunity to act there, to be in a play. So the desire starts to surface once again.
Yes.
Right?
And then
how does that desire stay alive? How does it start to develop? What goes on after that?
I discovered the arts, and I wanted to... I wanted to explore that more. So I took some sculpture classes and some art classes and did really well. And so this is the first time, this is my first time in education that I was ever really successful. I think I had a 0.6 in high school at one point for one of my semesters. And of course it wasn't a lack of intelligence. It was just I was checked out.
Right.
At least that's what I like to claim. In college, things changed. I was getting recognized for my work, and that was a first for me. 25, 26 years old, and that's the first time I had really discovered that, I might have something to offer. So it was wonderful. And it was scary at the same time. Scary in the sense that, that I didn't know how to deal with compliments. I didn't know how to deal with people saying they liked my work. It was such an odd feeling and odd thing to hear.
Hmm. Okay, so you're now really going into the arts, sculpting and all sorts of things.
Mm-hmm.
Now give us kind of what the journey looks like, as straight or as jagged as it was. From an interest in the arts and doing some sculpting and so on, to the point that you're working in the different facets of filmmaking.
So I'm at Hope College, and it's my senior year, and I am a double major. I'm a major in education and a fine arts major. And one of my professors, a painting professor at Hope, had a friend in town who was filming a movie called The Last Big Attraction, and they had just lost their art director. And he thought that we should talk because I had experience in theater, and he thought we would hit it off, and we did. And his name was Hopwood Dupree, the director. And he said, you think you can do this? And I was like, sure. He's like, you think you can do that? And I was like, sure.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had to go figure out how to do all of it. It was the worst grades I had in my college career were that semester, because I spent most of my time making a movie and not going to class. But I made it through.
Did you love it?
I did.
Okay.
Yeah, I did. It was I love the idea that it's the same reason why I love acting, and it's the idea that you can put a smile on people's face. You can take them somewhere. You can take them on a journey. And I enjoyed doing that. And it was fun to watch that process happen on film and to see the final.
Okay, but, so let me stop you for a second. Let me just ask you to define some terms for us here, because
now
I'm jumping ahead of the story a little bit, but you know there are so many things you've done in terms of filmmaking. I don't know if that's even the correct term to use, but
yeah, sure.
You've been involved with producing, directing, screenwriting, and production design and art direction. So what are the differences between all of those things? How would you roughly define those different things? Producing. This means what?
Producing is pretty much the business end of things.
Okay.
Producers typically get together and they're the ones that put together the director with the script, with the production designer, with all the key departments, the cinematographer, and so on. We also handle the business end of things, before the film and after the film. So for like What If and some of these other films that we've done, we're still taking care of stuff for those films today, and we will for the life of the film. So
okay,
so that's more business side of things.
Okay, so you since you mentioned this as you were describing that, what does it mean to be involved with production design and art direction?
Production design and art direction, we work with the director and we try to understand his or her vision and do our best to help them accomplish that vision visually. So it's set design, locations, makeup even.
Lighting,
props. The lighting, not so much. I mean, like the lighting is pretty much the cinematographer's area of expertise. But nonetheless, I mean, we're all working together for one goal. So the director's job is to keep us all on the same page and keep us pointing in the right direction, keep us motivated.
Okay.
Everything else.
So now you're describing what the director does. He's actually the front lines, hands-on, I'm guessing, how you describe this with all the elements of the film.
Yeah, there might be some people who are, if there's anybody out there in the film industry that might be laughing and thinking, anybody can direct. And that's that if you put, you hire the most talented people in the world, some people will say the director just shows up. But that's not been my experience. My experience has been, especially for these low-budget films, is that they really have to be a motivator, a person who really knows what it takes to put a movie together and can steer everybody in the right direction very quickly. The films that we make are, like I said, the smaller budget films, and consequently, you don't have the time to shoot like some of the big features do.
Mm-hmm.
So we might have to make a feature in 14 days, where they have maybe 40 days to shoot a feature of the same length, just because time is money. And so that requires your director to be top notch and know what he can and can't do. And yeah, it's a lot of work.
Okay. And screenwriting. I mean, this is writing not only the story, but I mean every line that every actor says, and even the music in the background and other things
that
come in to complement the story and what's being said.
Sure, even the action, yeah. And it's really new for me, and I've fallen in love with it. You asked me the other day. You said, do you feel like everything in your life has come together for? How did you say it?
This moment.
Yeah, for this moment, and that rang true for me. I mean, even in Jerusalem Countdown 2, which is not necessarily a story that I really am dying to tell, that I'm getting paid to tell. But, every aspect of my life, some of the failures, some of my successes, they have all made their way into this script. in one form or another. I could pull from those experiences and put those into a character. And that's really been really rewarding for me. It's been great.
Okay, so let me kind of take the pause button off as I was asking you to define some terms for us here. Okay,
did I get off track?
No. You went just exactly where I asked you to go, and that was really helpful. I mean, that's a little bit of the behind the scenes that I think some of us are just really curious about. But let's go back to your journey now. So with your journey, you talked about that college course. You talked about producing that film and how much you loved it. Now take us. Okay, so keep us going down the road with your story.
I guess what type of filmmaker I've become is not what I expected. While I've always been a Christian, I've always had issues with Christian films, and not necessarily in the sense that they're making them. It's just I always wanted to make something different. I wanted to make films for. I don't want to make films for Christians. I wanted to make films for non-Christians. That involves sometimes not steering away from reality, not steering away from the tragedy that so many people find their lives in. And I've really wanted to make Christian films that are for non-Christians. And not Christian films for the Christian audience.
And what makes it hard to do that? I mean, I take it from what you're saying. This is what you want to do, but so far,
the
experiences you've had have all been in the Christian film industry.
What's
hard about getting into making, quote, non-Christian films?
Well, if you want to go out and make a film that's a non-Christian film, you can go out there and do that. If you want to make a Christian film for non-Christian audiences, well, then you're dealing with the distribution aspect of film. And that's really distribution for all film is what drives the content. Whatever is selling drives, you know, the next load of content. And traditionally, films that have one foot in the secular world and one foot in the Christian world do terrible because there's no defined audience. You always have to.
Can you give us an example
of a film that's done terrible?
Yeah, something that tried to be a Christian film but work well in the Christian non-Christian audience, and just
There's nothing that I know that's out there, and the reason that I know of films that have. That Christians put, you know, $3 million into of somebody's hard-earned money and thinking that they were going to save the world with this one film. And it sits on a shelf and never gets seen by anyone because the distributors won't touch it. And that's tragic.
So let me ask you this. So distributors won't touch it. Will they not touch it because it's religious and they don't want to hurt their reputation, or simply it's a money issue? They're looking at
it's
saying,
it's a total money issue.
Not going to sell. Okay.
Yeah, it's a total money issue. You know, a lot of people think the whole Passion of the Christ, you know, but Mel Gibson got in trouble for that. It was a money issue. It wasn't anything against Jesus Christ or Christianity or anything like that. It was simply a money issue. He bypassed distributors. He made a $25 million film and didn't check with the machine to see if it was okay that he did that. He just took his own money and went for it. Now, that's an example of a Christian film that does have one foot. Well, it doesn't have one foot in the secular world, but he doesn't shy away from the violence. I mean, it's a rated R film. It's the highest grossing rated R film ever.
See, that absolutely amazes me. Now, I want to admit for a second that I really can't watch that movie. It's too violent for me. Now, are there more violent movies as far as bloodshed and all? Yes, but not in a meaningful, deeply personal way. I just can't watch that film. It just does something to me, the violence of it. And, you know, and yet there's the honesty of what the sacrifice of Christ really was. So, I mean, I'm with you. That was an extremely violent film.
Yeah.
But so well done.
Well, it was truthful.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, I think that's, you need to respect your audience. And I think oftentimes the Christian audience just doesn't demand more from the filmmakers and from the distributors, and you know, so you kind of get these whitewashed stories that, you know, like are give people warm and fuzzies in the church, but really have no impact on people who are dealing with the reality in their life of sexual abuse or of, you know, alcoholism or whatnot. No, I don't want to take anything away from the Kendrick brothers and what they did with Fireproof. I think Fireproof has saved marriages. I think it's done wonderful things. I'm not by any means attacking them.
Mm-hmm.
I just see that there's definitely a place that I wish that we could get to faster that reaches people for Christ. I remember I told you the other day about The Cross and the Switchblade. I think that would make a fabulous, relevant movie if it was, you know, somebody took it and put it in contemporary times and made it for, you know, and instead of making it for the Christian audience, making it for the, you know, the Cholo in South Central Los Angeles, who's, you know, living day to day, not knowing when the last day is going to be.
Mm-hmm. And what you were telling me before, and you're alluding to it now, that honestly, in reality, money is a huge issue, and the more money you can put into a movie to make it where, you know, the world is going to see it because the quality level is so high, it just takes a lot of money, right? Which is scary.
Yeah, and you know that goes back to the distributors as well. Let's say I make a movie, and the distributor likes it. Well, they have to find we either have to come up with the $2 million for prints and advertising for a theatrical release, or they do. And so it's not just the money that you spend on the movie while you're making it. It's also the money that needs to be spent and risked to advertise it. So that's why the advertisers get their money first. Those guys get paid back first.
So when we see a film, you know, you go on Internet Movie Database,
yeah,
and it tells you what the gross budget of the film was, is that just simply the film production, or does that also include, like you said, all the millions in distribution and advertising, promotion, and so on?
You know, it's different. You can't really trust those numbers. Those numbers are sometimes they're not entirely accurate. Some of them will include it, and some of them don't. So you really don't know.
Yeah.
And oftentimes people won't even put the correct number up there because they're either looking to sell it or, you know, just for political reasons. But I mean, for the big ones, it's pretty close to probably both.
Okay.
Being included.
So what would be an average median kind of budget for, you know, the kind of movie that goes to the theaters and does well? Would you say that is 20 million? 10 million, 50 million, 1 million?
Oh, man, you're asking me questions I'm a little out of school in. I don't know. I'd be afraid to even guess. I mean, because it is such a, you know, the guy who does the movie for, you know, $2 million and ends up, you know, making $300 million in the box office. It's just, you know, there's those kind of guys. And then, you know, you get your typical epic from Hollywood that, you know, anywhere from $200 million. I mean, it's insane the kind of money they spend.
Yeah. Okay, so you've been involved in many movies, actually. I just listed in Basecamp and The Secret Garden a few, and then we put the trailers up and so on. Is that hard when you're doing these Christian films where the Christian theme is very out there, it's very direct. Is it hard to get actors to be in these films, or not really?
We've had success. They of course want to read the script first. The last few films that we've done, we've had some control over the content. We've had control over the script, and that's helped, I think, because we've done our best to meet the needs of the Christian market, but do it in such a way that how the story unfolds is natural, and so it doesn't all of a sudden become a sermon in the middle of a movie. You know, I mean, sometimes you'd be watching a Christian movie and it's like the person turns and looks at the camera and, you know, there's a you know, an altar call right there.
Right. You know, the story just stopped for that second.
Yeah. Right. And, you know, I think that's you can do that. You know, but it's not what we wanted to do. We wanted to tell a story. We wanted to entertain people and we wanted to get them thinking about, thinking about things. We're in the movie business for the long haul. We want to continue to make movies, and don't think one movie is going to change it all. So we try to spread it out.
Okay, so these movies, where again they're just blatantly Christian, and I mean in a very well written, articulate way. When you get like, you know, Jerusalem Countdown, like, you know, What If, and all these, do you try to find Christian actors, those who profess to be Christians, to play these roles because of the lines, or is that not even a factor?
Well, that's a tough one. You know, you want to find, of course, I mean, on the set, from the grips to the camera department to the producers to the PAs, you want to find the best people for the job, and you're hoping that as a producer, you'll be able to witness to them by the way that you operate and work on set and work as a unit. With actors, you know, like for What If, Kevin Sorbo is, you know, is a Christian, and a lot of the actors that joined us claim to be. But I think for some of the parts, the key parts, you know, I think sometimes it takes a Christian to really be in this particular type of moment where it's, you know, only a Christian would know what it's like to hand their heart over to Jesus and know what that's like. The scene that I sent you with Jackie Velasquez and forgetting the actor's name right now. Anyway, he's a pretty strong Christian, and he was going through some pretty rough things as we were filming Jerusalem Countdown 1, and he just brought things to the film that I don't think a non-believer could bring, you know. So it's really no offense to those actors out there. I mean, I'm sure that there's some actors, really talented people, Oscar-winning actors that could, you know, maybe do it. But what he was able to bring to the film was amazing. And we get compliments on his work all the time. Hmm. The path along to him, because it was just so truthful.
Now, Bob Kane asked a question in a chat line, and he said, how much do you see value in entertaining people for its own sake, just to entertain and lighten their hearts?
It goes back to my whole reason why I fell in love with acting. You know, I think that's an important part of it. I think to be a storyteller, you have to really want to reach people's hearts and to make them smile and to take them somewhere else or to make them think deeper. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if I can put – how did he ask that question again?
Well, he's asking the value – how much do you value this idea of lightening a person's heart, entertaining them, capturing them?
Yeah, tremendously. I mean, that's – I don't know, that seems to be central to why I do it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I it's gotten me in trouble being too sensitive or wanting to fight for the scene to be in the film because I think it's important to people's hearts. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mindless. I have a trouble with the mindless entertainment stuff, and I've done enough of that. So I definitely lean towards emotive, character-driven pieces for sure.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. So John Hart has a question. He said, "I'm wondering what part of making movies Matt loves the most: acting, directing, editing. What is he doing when he feels most alive?"
Oh man, that's a great question. And if I had to say, I used to think it was acting, and then I saw myself on the screen, and I was like, oh my gosh, I hate seeing myself on the screen. and so I was like, I don't know if I can do this anymore. I'm gonna have to do Jerusalem Countdown 2, just because, you know, I was Nick Tanner in 1, but I think that might be unless the Lord tells me differently, I think that might be the last time I'm on film. I really enjoyed writing. I really did. I enjoyed it more than I ever thought I would. I'd spend 14 hours in my basement. My wife would come down and be like, I forgot to eat lunch. And she'd be like, how do you do this? She has no idea. She's a physical therapist, and so she lives in a completely different world than I do. And so the writing has been fun. And I love doing the editing.
Is that what you mean?
Yeah. Well, okay. I mean, I don't love like the programs like Avid and all that stuff. I get lost in those things. But I love sitting with the editor and shaping a scene. Again, I go back to the whole sculpture idea. It's sculpting with words and if you can, it's amazing what you can do with a scene. We did Mickey Madsen. And I flew out to LA and we worked for, I don't know, 4 or 5 days straight in the editing bay. And we worked on crafting the edit to a point to where we were really happy with it. And, just by massaging the scene that was just ill-written from the get-go, we were able to create something out of it with, bits and pieces from the outtakes or whatever, what have you, and actually make some fun things. I enjoy that a lot, too. But I'm definitely not an editor.
So really the more accurate word for your heart, for your compelling, for your brilliance is sculpting, and it happens to be in the area of storytelling to film right now.
Yeah.
And it sounds like it's most specifically, I mean, the most direct way is writing the story and then making sure the story comes out the right way in kind of the editing booth.
Yeah. Yeah, huh. Absolutely. And, my friend was asking me, well, why don't you direct it? And I'm like, well, first of all, I don't know if the company would allow me to direct it, being that I haven't directed a feature yet. And then the second thing is, and this is an interesting topic.
But can't you just show it to him and say, but, you know, the director's worthless. We don't need a director.
I could.
Yeah.
they very well might say that. My friend who's a screenwriter, he lives out in Los Angeles, does a ton of work. We had this conversation the other day, and it's like, do I want my name on a film, a Christian action end times thriller film? Is that how I want to be presented to Hollywood? And it poses a really interesting question because I'm quickly gaining a reputation as being a Christian filmmaker, and I don't know if I want that reputation. I'm proud of being a Christian, or I'm grateful to be counted amongst Christians. But if you get labeled Christian filmmaker in Hollywood, it's a tough go.
Mm-hmm.
It's a tough go. I still want to be able to tell stories that maybe are in their essence Christian at the center, but digestible by everybody. The masses can go see it, and and relate to it for one reason or the other, and have it be real and not be afraid of language and not be afraid of tough scenes that, you know, portray people in the correct light. So, you know, but back to the Passion of the Christ and how violent that was and how awful that was. And you're thinking, gosh, it was probably worse than that. It's tough. So I don't know.
So, you know, we've heard, and I want to be careful of time here. We need to wrap this up pretty soon. But I want to ask a question. Well, I guess I have been doing that. Anyway, my question would be this. I've heard that it is a pretty tough thing to be a Christian in Hollywood. And I mean, there could be two sides of that question. Is walking with God in the midst of the industry and the crowd and everything else. But I actually meant it more the other way of, I've just heard there's so much opposition, resistance, sidelining, you know, of people that are known as believers. So I'm asking that question, and I'm doing it in the light of, and this may be wrong, this may be incorrect, that there probably is a Christian movie circle out there that people can operate in where it's fairly comfortable because we all understand each other. But anyway, can you answer that? Maybe I just convoluted my question.
No. People ask me about, you know, what was it like to live in Los Angeles? And I don't know. I feel God's grace more there than anywhere. I don't know if that's just me and my experience, what I bring to Los Angeles when I go there, and what's on my heart. I have a love for the place. My experience with the industry has never been negative on Christians. I think that it's negative on Christians who are intolerable. Who maybe speak before they listen. I've witnessed that a lot, and that's always been difficult. I think there's not been many cunning warriors, as you guys would say, out there. I think they're not careful enough. My experience has been with the kind of being a Christian, not veering away from it. I had one girl ask me one time when I was first going out there. She said, "Can I ask you a question?" I was like, "Sure." Like, "Are you gay?" And I'm like, what? The first thought that came to my mind was, "Well, what am I doing that makes you think I'm gay? Like what? You know?" And I was just like, "No." She's like, "Because you're so nice." And our conversation kind of developed, and I kind of avoided her because I felt like the Holy Spirit was saying, you know, this is an opportunity for you to witness to somebody. And I kind of avoided it, and I avoided it, and I avoided it. And then all of a sudden, we had to drive across Los Angeles. We were shooting a pilot for Warner Brothers. And all of a sudden, I had to drive across Los Angeles, which were in rush traffic. So I was in the car with her for well over an hour. And we ended up talking about her life as a lesbian and being sexually molested by her uncle and cousins. And I mean, just this heartbreaking story. And, you know, and I was able to witness to her as a Christian and her experience with, you know, Christians, according to her, was pretty awful, especially with some of the stories that she had told me. So, you know, I don't know. I don't know if that answers your question or not, but my experience has been if I'm respectful to people, then they're typically pretty respectful back.
Yeah. No, that's a very powerful story, too, of just she's got to find a category for your kindness. And
yeah.
I'm just guessing in her thinking, her only category to put that kindness is in the category of being gay.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's just amazing. I find I just really lose touch with the world out there because I get to hang around with some really amazing people, you know, almost all of them being believers. And
yeah.
Sometimes I just go, man, I just have not seen the condition of the world. The other thing that strikes me is there's so many people that, you know, they're like that as believers, and they like to think that they're just getting persecuted for their faith. And I want to say, you know what? If you weren't a believer, I wouldn't like you any more than I like you as a believer. You're just obnoxious. You know, you just don't know how to relate to people. You need to grow up,
yeah,
and get Christianity for a minute. But I love,
yeah,
how they love to play the, you know, persecuted for my outspoken faith. You want to say, no, you're persecuted because you're an idiot.
Yeah.
You know? So, yeah, that's okay. So, let me ask this last thing, because this is fascinating. We could easily, you know, go over an hour, but I don't want us to do that. And so here's my question. And let me preface it. I think there are a number of us listening thinking, gosh, I wish I were in Matt's place. I wish I was producing movies. And I think it's cool he's producing Christian movies. I mean, he's doing it. Maybe he'd like to do something a little bigger or a little different in a different arena, but he's doing it. I mean, he's reached his dream. Now, with that idea, that assumption that many of us are thinking that, what is life like for you right now with being involved in different aspects of movie making and a partner with 10 West Productions? And I mean, what's your everyday life like?
Well, today it was my wife crying on my shoulder. I mean, for everybody out there, today was an unusually rough day. And us talking about insurance for our son, and you know, what's the next step? And okay, I'm writing now. What does that look like for our future? My wife's a physical therapist, and she's been working a couple of days out of a week, just because she likes to stay involved. But you know, she doesn't want to go work anymore and take our son to daycare. She wants, it might be the only son we ever have. Just because of the complications and how difficult he was to bring into this world. Today was tough. It was life as an artist, not having, you know, a company and a pension and a health insurance plan and all the other stuff. It was some real issues that we have to deal with, and living in the Midwest now doesn't help. Living in Los Angeles would be so much easier. But then I don't want to raise my son there necessarily. I don't know. Go ahead.
Well, so here you are struggling with, you know, financial questions like we all do. Are we going to make it? How are we going to do this? And the struggle of, well, I could be here, but I'd rather raise my son here. I here you've already admitted, you know, I'd love to produce a different kind of film. You have other dreams, and you're working toward it, and you've accomplished quite a bit. I mean, so many of us just dream about something and never try to step into it, and then actually engage the hard process of, you know, awakening, deepening, and fulfilling, or you know, the developmental process. You have been in that, and you've been doing that. But I just want everybody to hear that life is not like, you know, the Hollywood pictures that we see, that everything's taken care of. You've got pampered life.
I wish. Yeah, I didn't fly out to Vegas last weekend, you know, to have dinner at, you know, whatever the place is that's cool and hip, and fly back. And no, it's especially for Christian films. I mean, it's just that it's not as lucrative as people think it is. And I mean, it's, I think for some of the companies out there, they're finding a way to turn a dollar, but you know, it's very much a slugfest daily, in and out. So.
Okay, so one more question. And I think I mean it this time. So you know, in Basecamp and Secret Garden. And of course, outside of those as well, there are so many people that have gotten some clarity as to what they feel compelled to do. They haven't entered into it yet, but now that at least they have some clarity, and you know, they're fighting with, you know, kind of the sentence your sister even gave you way back then is, really, it's one in a million. You don't have a chance. That's silly. or thinking I can never become that, or I'm too old now, or I'm not old enough, or whatever that is, what would you kind of throw out as your experience, kind of what you've learned, and just to say, well, let me kind of encourage you with a few things here from my experience that God has done for me or taught me or taken me through. What would those things be?
Wow.
And I know I didn't prep you for that question.
No, well, it's okay. You know, I mean, it's. Gratitude is. I'm grateful that God's taken care of me. I mean, looking back, I'm like, wow, He's really cleared a path for me, and I'm thankful for that. I've continued to risk. Albeit it's been calculated too much, and I feel like God's asking me to do more, and that's scary. We had this conversation the other day. I feel like I have to, you know, risk in ways that I'm very uncomfortable risking. But nonetheless, that's been part of it, and fighting for the answers. You know, does that make sense? Fighting for the answers.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's why we're probably all part of this group. I haven't been content with where I've been and where I am, and I feel like there's more, and I'm trying to find it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And, you know, going back to this idea of risk, and you and I did talk about that, because I feel like I am too risk adverse. I'm too safe.
You said that so much better than I. Yes, risk adverse. Perfect.
You know, I'm nuancing the words a little bit here for me. I years ago, I was with another organization. I was sent to a leadership training group. And they had all these clinical psychologists, and they'd watch you do all these different things, and they'd take these different tests, and then they would give you their feedback on the last day. And this guy, as I was driving to this place, it was called the Center for Creative Leadership, and they're around the world. And as I was driving, I was saying, now, God, I really want you to make clear what it is you're saying to me, and let me throw out the rest. And so what was really fascinating is when I got in this room, and, of course, they had tape recorders on and even a video camera, and he was speaking to me. He did say to me, he said, okay, first of all, I want you to understand I'm a believer. And he said, so I think I have an understanding of your life, which is just phenomenal that I ended up getting this clinical psychologist that was a believer. But he did say to me, he said, Gary, he said, you are so cautious. He said, you know, some people you have to talk about living with wisdom, you know, count the cost, really stop and determine what is this going to take, he said. I want to say to you, whenever you're afraid of something, just do it, because you will never do a really stupid thing. You can't do it. He said, you have too much caution to play in your life. And I think it's true. I mean, I have to play the, Gary, you're going to have to take a risk here. And I just think what you said is huge. You know, that at some point we have to risk either speaking up or trying something or risking some finances or the risk you're playing right now of how are we going to do this with insurance and everything else, but stick in what we believe God wants us to do. And
well, it's, you know, I said calculated risk too. I'm used to taking the calculator. I mean, even with a lot of this film stuff, I mean, much of it's calculated. You know, I know that I can do this budget film. I know that I can work within these parameters. You know, but I mean, moving ahead, I mean, with my son being 16 months old and you know, my wife and everything. It's one thing to risk me. It's been a whole other ball game for me to say to my wife and to my son, yeah, I'm gonna risk you guys too. you know, that goes back to some of my, you know, some of my childhood and what it means to be a man and being looked to by my wife to make decisions and my son looking at me and me wanting to come through for him and wanting to to be a father to him that just different than the father that I had. I love my dad, but it's different.
Well, let me end with a comment that Bob gave here, Bob Kane, it was such a good one, and he just said, you know, the whole family has to be in on the risk steps, don't they?
Yeah.
And I have known men that love risk, and they do it without ever bringing their family along, and that's usually a disaster that's just waiting to happen. And on the other hand, I do think that men who will not take any risks and even involve their family, you know, trying to bring their family in, that's eventually going to be, I think, this disaster of boredom, you know. And so
it's like the parable of the talents, right?
Yeah. Well, Matt, thank you. This has been really fascinating for all of us listening to your story. You know, people have loved your honesty that you've given us during this time, and it's just been really good.
Well, thank you.
And I want to encourage everyone, you need to see these films. They're really good. Since we've talked, Matt and I, a couple of weeks ago, I've watched, well, the ones I could get on Netflix, I watched those immediately, and they really are good. Matt, you've been masterful in your different parts you've played in these. And I liked you as an actor, though it was only probably 90 seconds. In what,
as the nurse?
Yeah. I'll have to tell everyone real quickly. What was so funny was we were watching this. I was watching this with my daughter. And when you were in that scene, and I mean, it's in the last 30 minutes of the movie, I think.
Yeah. Towards the end.
I saw you there, and I didn't recognize you because I didn't have a context. I wasn't looking for you. And I remember I said to my daughter, I said, man, was that guy in an earlier scene? Because he looks really familiar to me, but I don't think I've seen him. And as we watched the credits, there you were. And I thought, oh, that's unbelievable.
So
you did a great job in that,
seconds. Thank you very much.
So, anyway, thank you.
Well, it's an honor to be on. Thank you, Gary.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you, everyone. It's been a good evening, and we'll talk to you in a week. Bye-bye.